Internet giant Google is denying reports that it's reached an agreement with Verizon over broadband service. The two have been talking about a deal that would ensure speedier delivery of Google's content for a price. And that stirred angry responses from public interest advocates who fear that such a deal would lead to a two-tiered internet. Verizon and Google had been part of closed-door negotiations convened by the Federal Communications Commission on the future of broadband regulations. As Joel Rose reports, those talks are now apparently on hold.
As reported this morning by the New York Times and others, the deal would allow Verizon to speed up some of the content flowing through its pipes if the creators of that content are willing to pay extra. That would be a major departure from the internet of today, where all traffic is supposed to flow through those pipes at the same speed, whether it's a big Hollywood movie or some guy's home video of a double rainbow in California.
Too much! I don't know what it means.
Despite what you might be thinking, this is an important point. The idea that broadband companies have to treat all of the traffic on their networks equally is known as net neutrality, and it's what allows you to use any application or visit the most obscure websites with equal ease. Net neutrality advocates worry that a Google-Verizon deal, as reported, would mean the end for the open internet and the beginning of a new two-tiered internet with a fast lane for the biggest companies and a slow lane for everyone else. Gigi Sohn is the founder of the Washington, D.C. nonprofit Public Knowledge.
The things that are going to come over your internet pipe faster and with better quality are the same things you see on cable television, the Time Warners, the Disneys, the CNNs. And it becomes more and more difficult for the YouTubes, the next YouTubes of the world, to make a splash, the next Twitters of the world, the next Tumblrs of the world, because they are put in the slow lane.
Both Verizon and Google declined to be interviewed for this story. Google is denying reports that it talked with Verizon about, quote, paying for carriage of Google or YouTube traffic. A spokesman for Verizon would only say that the two companies have been talking for 10 months about broadband policy that would support, quote, an open internet and the investment and innovation required to sustain it. It's no secret that the phone and cable companies that deliver broadband to most American homes would like to charge content companies a premium for faster service. Rebecca Arbogast is managing director at the investment firm Stifel Nicolaus. She says those companies are already getting what they can out of consumers.
There's a limit to what you or I are going to be willing to pay for broadband service to our homes. They're hoping to be able to find some other revenue sources by charging the apps companies and the content companies themselves. So what it basically would do would be allow them to harvest from a whole new set of revenue sources.
The future of net neutrality has been a hot topic this summer in Washington. Both Verizon and Google participated in a series of closed-door negotiations at the FCC about the future of broadband regulation. By all accounts, the FCC was trying to broker a deal on net neutrality and other sticky issues that the broadband providers and big internet companies can all live with.
We're not ashamed to invest on behalf of our customers. We really want to provide them the very best possible services, and we're willing to invest to do it.
Amazon.com Vice President Paul Meisner laid out one potential compromise in an editorial last month. Meisner says broadband providers should be allowed to offer faster service, and that internet companies like his should be allowed to pay more for the privilege if they want.
We believe that network operators ought to be able to provide special services so long as they are equally available and do not harm other traffic.
Meisner says that last point is crucial. The cable giant Comcast was caught slowing some traffic on its network in 2007, leading to a court case that is called the FCC's regulatory authority over broadband into question. And net neutrality advocates say any compromise allowing new fast lanes on the internet should be carefully defined so that the big broadband companies don't put all their investment into premium services, in effect creating a slower second-class network for everyone who can't afford to pay. Ultimately, the FCC's closed-door negotiations ended without an agreement. The FCC officially called off the talks today. Gigi Sohn at Public Knowledge says that's a step in the right direction.
If two big corporate behemoths want to sing kumbaya and come to an agreement, that's fine. But it shouldn't be the basis for public policy. Go ahead and do your thing. But we're talking about the fate of the most democratic medium we've ever known. And it shouldn't be left up to the business whims of Google and Verizon or any two or four or six companies.
Sohn would like to see the FCC go back to the plan it announced in May and impose tougher regulations to ensure that broadband providers abide by the principles of net neutrality. But in any case, she hopes to see more stakeholders at the negotiating table if talks resume. For NPR News, I'm Joel Rose.
More All Things Considered in a moment. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Bloch.
And I'm Michelle Norris, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. Geeks, tech heads, and open internet advocates were on pins and needles all weekend. They were waiting for an announcement between Google and Verizon that, rumor had it, might change the internet forever. Well, that announcement came this afternoon, and as NPR's Neda Ulubi reports, it wasn't quite what anyone expected.
You could almost hear the air of anticipation whooshing out of a telephone conference call with Google CEO Eric Schmidt.
This is not a deal. This is a joint policy announcement.
The deal, reporters expected, would let Google pay Verizon to get certain content online faster than its competitors. Instead, Schmidt and his Verizon counterpart set forth a plan, a sort of statement of intent, promising to maintain the internet's openness and integrity.
We enjoy August drama, but this is not our dramatic moment, I think.
August drama, I don't know.
Siva Vaidyanathan is a professor of media studies and law at the University of Virginia. He was on the conference call, too.
It was no Mad Men.
But just like that hit cable drama about ad men in the 1960s, there's a backdrop of corporate control and intent that's not always crystal clear, despite Schmidt's repeated assurances of transparency. Vaidyanathan says this is the problem.
All of these companies have short-term vested interests in maintaining their power. Verizon always wants to be Verizon. Google will always want to be the biggest company on the web.
So he's a little suspicious of the deals those companies cut and how they might try to influence policy.
Because fundamentally, Google doesn't work for you or me, and Verizon certainly doesn't work for you or me.
Nevertheless, Google's Eric Schmidt today laid out a set of principles, including preserving an open internet.
Our proposal would establish a new and enforceable prohibition against discrimination for wireline broadband internet services.
He's talking about what's called net neutrality, making sure all applications and all users are treated equally, without the companies that sell us access blocking or slowing down content. But Schmidt specifically said wireline, not wireless, which would mean smartphones, for example. Unlike your desktop, those have restrictions on which applications you can use. That worries Siva Vaidyanathan.
As we shift more and more of our use to these smaller mobile devices, we want to make sure that the next YouTube and the next Skype can arise in this new environment.
A new environment that may not have the kind of net neutrality that fostered the internet we're used to. But Adam Thier takes a different point of view. He is the president of the Progress and Freedom Foundation, a think tank that looks at the internet revolution from a free market perspective. He wonders why the internet should be different from any other industry.
From airlines where you have first class versus coach to hotels where you have nice rooms versus smaller ones. It just means it is not as special as the premium offering.
But access to information is different from access to hotels, says Professor Siva Vaidyanathan. And he hopes the Federal Communications Commission takes that into account.
If the FCC uses this agreement between two private companies as a template for policy, we are just going to essentially allow for a whole lot of top-down control in the very areas where use seems to be moving.
Neda Ulubi, NPR News.
Last week, we kicked off an occasional series of conversations with CEOs of tech companies, big and small. In the zeitgeist is this idea that to be a founder of an internet startup, you have to be a nerdy genius type in your early 20s. Think Sergey Brin of Google or Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg. Well, the company CB Insights collects data about private companies and has just released a report on the founders of internet startups. They tracked 185 internet companies between January and June of 2010 to see what kind of leadership is attractive to venture capitalists looking to invest. Anand Sanwal is the CEO and co-founder of CB Insights. He joins me now. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Melissa.
And your report basically debunks this whole notion of startup founders being brainiac 20-somethings living in Silicon Valley, right? You say wunderkinds, not the norm.
You know, amongst several findings, this was one that I think was surprising. Pop culture would have you believe that the Mark Zuckerbergs of the world are commonplace. The average age of the founding teams was in the 35 to 44 age range, which, you know, seems to indicate that VCs are funding folks with, you know, some amount of experience and maturity in the business world.
VCs being venture capitalists.
Venture capitalists, exactly.
Overwhelmingly, this group of internet founders was male, we should say.
Yeah, it was 92% male founders.
Okay. And if you're looking at education, the educational background of these folks, what'd you find?
We, to some degree, as expected, saw, you know, the states that these folks were educated in tended to be, you know, the Northeast and the West Coast. I think surprisingly, at the advanced degree analysis we did, Stanford was actually edged out by Harvard grads. And I think given Stanford's proximity to the whole Silicon Valley, we were surprised to see that it was kind of outdone by Harvard.
If you look at the kind of training that internet startup founders have educationally, what did you find?
When we looked at MBAs versus master's degrees in other disciplines, primarily master's of science, a majority of the teams had only MBAs on them, or the highest degree on the team was an MBA. On top of that, the MBAs at the national level actually received the largest funding rounds.
You also look at the racial makeup of internet startups, and you find that while whites make up 77% of the U.S. population, they are 87% of the internet founders. If you look at blacks, 11% of the overall population, just 1%. And for Asians, 4% of the U.S. population, but 12% of the internet startup founders. What do those numbers tell you?
Our view, again, was to just shed light on what the mix is. And we're seeing lots of conversation about why this may be the case. I can say sort of anecdotally, based on informal surveys we do of venture capitalists, what they tell us is there's not many black entrepreneurs, for instance, that they see in the process of getting pitched. You know, that I think that was one interesting highlight. I thought the other thing that came away from the report was the fact that all Asian teams actually raised the largest venture capital relative to other teams.
Anand Sanwal, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks, Melissa.
Anand Sanwal is the CEO of CB Insights. His company collects data about private businesses. It just released a report that looks at the founders of internet startups backed by venture capital.
Next, a high-profile stock offering. Skype lets you make telephone and video calls over the internet. About 125 million people use the company's mostly free services every month. Now the company is about to hold an IPO, or initial public offering, and sell some stock to the public. NPR's Wendy Kaufman has more.
Skype filed documents saying it wants to sell $100 million worth of shares that would be traded on the Nasdaq exchange. Attorney Joe Bartlett, an expert in these kinds of deals, suggests the company's rationale for the IPO.
The hope is that they can use the $100 million to create a $5 billion company. That's the bet. That's what IPOs are all about.
It will be challenging. Skype posted a modest profit this year, but it's had trouble making money. eBay, which bought the company in 2005 and sold most of it off last year, can attest to that. Getting people to pay for services that had been offered for free remains a challenge. So analysts expect the company to expand into more video conferencing, mobile use, and document storage and sharing. But Skype will likely face competition from the likes of Google and Microsoft. Still, Wharton professor David Hsu suggests the offering is an encouraging sign.
Relative to the last 2 years or so in which the IPO markets have been stone cold, things are starting to pick up a bit.
He adds, we don't know how successful this or a handful of other recently announced IPOs will be, but at least companies are again considering the IPO option. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. Now an update on Saudi Arabia's threat to ban BlackBerry service. Today, BlackBerry users there were assured they can continue messaging each other. Authorities had threatened to block service unless the device manufacturer made BlackBerry communications more accessible to the government. Saudi officials won't say how their concerns were met, and as NPR's Tom Gelton reports, that has democracy advocates throughout the Middle East worried their communications will no longer be private.
The government's now objecting to BlackBerry usage. Saudi Arabia, but also the United Arab Emirates, India, Tunisia, and others say their concern is security. By encrypting electronic communications, these governments say, a BlackBerry makes it possible for terrorist groups to conspire without the knowledge of the authorities. John Verdi, senior counsel at the Electronic Privacy Information Center, says people buy and use BlackBerries precisely because they want their communication to stay private.
They are transmitting sensitive information, whether it's business information or political information or free speech information, that they don't want to be accessible to anyone other than the sender.
Research in Motion, or RIM, the company that makes BlackBerries, has never said how exactly it encrypts communications to make them secure, and it won't say how it has now met the Saudi demands for more access to those communications. RIM officials briefed State Department officials yesterday, but spokesman Philip Crowley today only hinted at what they said.
Their perspective was that they believe that there are, broadly speaking, solutions available that, on a country-by-country-by-country basis, can satisfactorily address and balance the regulatory, security, and access issues that are at stake.
BlackBerry messages are passed through servers in Canada, where RIM is based, and in Britain, but not elsewhere. Some reports say RIM has now agreed to establish BlackBerry servers in Saudi Arabia. That could be critical, says John Verdi, because at some point in their transmission, even encrypted messages get translated into plain text.
It's unclear whether these messages are going to be translated into plain text within Saudi Arabia or whether that's going to happen somewhere else. But locating the servers there certainly raises the possibility that these messages will become much more easily accessible to governments.
That's governments plural. One concern now is that other countries may now demand concessions similar to what RIM has apparently made to Saudi Arabia. But Matt Thornton, a telecom analyst at Avian Securities, says RIM would probably want separate deals with different governments.
I don't think it's plain vanilla. I think it's going to be much more on a case-by-case basis. So I think that's why this is very sensitive, and I don't think the details will ever reach, fully reach the light of day.
For dissidents and human rights activists in the Middle East, the worry is that the BlackBerry compromise, if repeated, would mean their private communications could now be monitored by government security agencies. Robert Guerra leads the Internet Freedom Project at Freedom House.
Internet users around the world aren't just using it to chat. They're using it to organize, to express themselves. And BlackBerry is positioning itself as a device where, it might not be safe to communicate.
In fact, democracy activists in the United Arab Emirates say they used BlackBerries to organize recent demonstrations there. They fear that's what prompted UAE authorities to propose a ban on BlackBerry communications beginning next month. For his part, telecom analyst Matt Thornton suspects the threats of BlackBerry suspensions by Middle East governments may in part be a bluff to force RIM to the bargaining table.
I don't think the governments have any vested interest in shutting down the BlackBerry service. I don't think the enterprises and consumers that use the product in those countries have any vested interest in having the service shut down. And I don't think RIM has any interest in having these services shut down in these high-growth markets. So, I think this was much more of a negotiating ploy.
Whatever the motivation, the government demands present Research in Motion with a dilemma. There are an estimated 1.5 million BlackBerry users in the Middle East. That's a lot to lose. But making deals to keep those customers may chase away others. It's the promise of privacy that attracts many BlackBerry users. In a statement last week, RIM said BlackBerry users can remain confident, quote, in the integrity of the security architecture without fear of compromise. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.